Lothrop Telephone Services. The Chesning Brant and New Lothrop Telephone Systems, each having free community telephone calling service with each other, are owned by the Central Telephone Company. This company also owns four other small telephone exchanges in Michigan at Orleans, Sunfield, Mecosta, and Chippewa Lake. It is a subsidiary of Century Telephone Enterprises, Incorporated, headquartered at Monroe, Louisiana. This parent company of Louisiana has diversified operations. It has various degrees of owning interests and administrative duties in 27 telephone operating companies that furnish services in portions of 9 states, 4 cable television, that is CATV, companies operating in portions of 3 states, 1 telephone equipment and supply company, 1 telephone central office installation company, and 5 service organizations, each allocated a specific portion of the 27 operating companies for the purpose of furnishing their customers the actual telephone service. One of these service organizations, Century Telephone Midwest Incorporated, is responsible for the telephone services of all of the Michigan telephone exchanges associated with Century Telephone Enterprises Incorporated. The 7 owned by Central Telephone Company, 1 owned by Public Service Telephone Company of Montrose, and 4 owned by the Midwest Telephone Company, Barkilla, Goodrich, Litchfield, and Mosierville. Without a doubt, it is difficult for some of us customers to understand who and where the responsibility lies when it comes to supplying us our desired telephone service with these 5 similar organizational names intertwined. Our first line of approach is to the Central Telephone Company organization. At the present time, there are 27 non-supervisory employees in the service organization, that is, the Century Telephone Midwest Incorporated Company, along with 6 supervisory personnel. As the non-supervisory employees' work involves them in various parts of Lower Michigan, they reside in various locations. Being that the division or headquarters office is located at 150 West Broad Street, Chesning, the supervisors reside in and work out of Chesning. This company has the following management personnel: L.G. Glover, division manager; C. Vincent Wright, division commercial manager; Ronald Krupp, plant installation manager; Richard Rickert, plant construction foreman; Larry Kost, central office chief; and J. Hardy, plant engineer. The parent company, Century Telephone Enterprise Incorporated, performs the overall administration, research, financing, billing, general engineering, purchasing, and or manufacturing of telephone equipment and supplies, and installing of central office equipment. Likewise, it is responsible for the handling of governmental and intercompany relations, along with the other activities conducive to an efficient general business operation. So much for the present. Let's go back to the early days of the telephone and its development over the last 100 years. This should help to give a clearer conception of our telephone services of today, as well as a historical picture of the past. Alexander Graham Bell, with the aid of a co-worker, Thomas A. Watson, first heard sound itself transmitted over electrical circuitry on June 2, 1875. He was keenly interested in developing methods of improving communications. He not only was applying his efforts in the development of ways and means of helping people that were suffering with speech and or hearing difficulties, he also was applying his inventive mind to the improvement of telegraphy communications at that time. On that day in Bell's attic workshop in Boston, they were attempting to transmit up to 3 telegraph messages simultaneously over 1 electrical circuit by wire. They were trying to adjust each of the 3 tuning forks to different vibrating sound frequencies and implant them on the electrical sending apparatus they were developing. Those three specific frequencies were to be received on their receiving apparatus in an adjacent location where Bell was located, Watson being at the sending end. Once these three separate frequencies were able to be sent and received individually without interference from each other, this would then be used as carrier of coded telegraph messages and thus save much expense of long circuits of wire. Three telegraph messages for practically the price of one. Well, that wasn't about to happen quite yet, although at a later time this did happen, and it was called harmonic telegraphy. As fate would have it, due to a maladjustment, a tuning fork stuck. While Watson was trying to free it by a flick of a finger, and in so doing, while moving it back and forth from the sending apparatus, a distinct noise was transmitted electrically to the receiving apparatus at Bell's end. He immediately recognized this for what it was, a great potential of transmitting noise and also the human voice. One of nature's mysteries was being unlocked to mankind. Bell and Watson became very dedicated to this project and were closely associated for years in the development and operation of telephone services. Their abilities complemented each other extremely well. Bell was well educated, had a very inventive mind, and was strongly dedicated to whatever he undertook. Watson had unusual mechanical ability, as well as electrical ability, which was a great boon in the development and manufacture of telephone equipment. He also was a good business administrator. With great perseverance, they both set about fervently building, testing, and rebuilding until the telephone was developed to the point that a patent was filed for it at the U.S. Patent Office on February 18, 1876. Their Bell telephone patent was granted on March 7, 1876. It was not filed any too soon, as just a few hours after Bell's patent was filed, a caveat was filed. This caveat read, "The art of transmitting vocal sounds or conversations, telegraphy, through an electric current, by an American inventor, Elisha Gray." Caveat was a Latin word or term associated with patents at that time, as an intention to invent a device or process described in it, rather than actually describing how it worked. It is no longer recognized by the U.S. Patent Office as the same as a patent. Later, there was great conjecture concerning who first invented the telephone. A lawsuit ensued, as Gray and Edison were selling patent licenses also. It was settled in November of 1879 in Bell's favor. As a result, the National Bell Telephone Company stock soared from $110 to $995 in just a short period of time after the settlement's announcement. This was the first of over 600 lawsuits involved in the telephone industry in its first 20 years of the industry's existence. Shortly after the patent was granted in 1876, Bell and Watson were experimenting. Bell was at the transmitting end, and Watson was in another room at the receiving end. Bell caught a button of his coat sleeve on the lip of a battery acid jar, spilling the electrolyte on his trousers. He called, "Mr. Watson, come here, I need you." This is the first known sentence verbally transmitted by electricity. Upon learning that Watson had heard him so distinctly over the electrical apparatus, Bell's consternation turned to delight. The use of the telephone was really on its way. What would life now be like were we still without electrical transmission of human intelligence? Say, without the invention of the telegraph, the telephone, and all other electrical transmission items, as the world was 150 years ago. No telegraph, no telephone, no teletype, no radio, no television, no distant pictures, no data transmission to planets, to satellites, to business networks. The real breakthrough started with the telegraph and really blossomed with the telephone. Telegraphy developed into commercial use in the period of 1820 to 1845. In 1844, Samuel Morse, with a telegraph code that he personally developed, publicly demonstrated its use by sending the sentence, "What hath God wrought?" on a one-wire grounded circuit from Washington to Baltimore. This firmly established commercial telegraphy. The word telegraph is derived from two Greek words, tele, for far away, and graph, for written. The word telephone is also derived from the Greek words tele, far away, and phone, for voice. From 1876, the telephone industry grew by leaps and bounds. Portions of this historical account may not seem to be involved with the telephone systems of Brandt, Chesning, and New Lothar, but without the overall telephone industry's development, our service would be very limited indeed. Chronologically, local telephone items will be interspersed in this account to quite a degree with the overall advancements of the industry. The first telephone company on record was called the Bell Telephone Company. It was organized in Boston in July of 1877. By November of that year, this company had 3,000 phones in service. When it was a year old, it had grown to 10,000 telephones. To our knowledge, the first switchboard was placed in service at Hartford, Connecticut in July of 1877, specifically for communication between doctors and their pharmacies. The first known telephone switching system in Michigan was placed in service at Detroit on August 15, 1878. On May 27, 1879, telephone service was established between Bay City and East Saginaw. Bell Telephone Company of Saginaw opened its telephone service between East Saginaw and Saginaw, later known as West Saginaw, on July 17, 1879. The Bell Telephone Company of Detroit was incorporated in 1881. Just from a reasonable deduction, our local communities must have been making plans for some telephone service shortly after that time, although it is difficult to find specific information to confirm it. In the May 28, 1898 issue of the Chesaning Argus, it carries an item stating that Parshallburg had just received long-distance service for their community. Quite frequently in those days, the Bell Company would establish what was known as a toll station in a community. It required the customer to visit that telephone premise to make or receive, at a predetermined time, a long distance, or now commonly called toll call. If Parshallburg had long distance service then, likely Chesaning and other nearby communities of any size had local and long distance service by or before that time. Chesaning's population was over 2,000 in the census of 1900, so likely the need or desire for telephone service was strong. Chesaning's first long-distance switching circuit, that is, a circuit terminating on a switchboard that could be interconnected with local telephone circuits, was established with St. Charles. Besides this, and a circuit to Brandt, St. Charles had a circuit to Saginaw, which in turn could be interconnected to localities of Michigan and all points east in the United States. Let's again return to the development of the telephone business on a national scale. By its very nature, its growth intermingled with separate localities and operations at a very fast rate. Alexander Bell continued to promote and spread the use of the telephone throughout the north and eastern part of the United States, as well as in Great Britain, Europe, and Canada. He took a secondary position in the actual organizing of telephone companies. Bell's associates, Gardner Hubbard, Thomas Sanders, and their influential well-to-do associates and friends, moved in to organize the telephone business. Thomas Watson came into the business not for his financial merit, but his great ability to handle and develop the technical part of the business. Bell's patents and overall ability made him a valuable asset in the companies that carried his name. The first company, Bell Telephone Company, with Gardner G. Hubbard trustee, was organized in Boston as of July 9, 1877. At the beginning, Hubbard decided that the company would have the overall telephone service under their control. Service, not necessarily the business. The company would not sell telephone instruments or equipment to the customers being served, but would furnish telephone service on a rental basis. Also, all other organizations that wish to furnish telephone service at other localities must buy a license of Bell's patent through this company and serve their customers in a similar manner. This not only kept Bell's patents in a desirable economic status for this company, it made a completely integrated network of telephone instruments, lines, central office, and toll equipment to furnish a good grade of telephone service throughout the country. Financially, the business of this Bell Telephone Company, headquartered in Boston, was inadequately financed as well as geographically limited. Sanders and Hubbard persuaded some of their New England business friends to invest money in a new company that they were forming in a corporate form and would extend over the other New England states. The New England Telephone Company came into existence on February 12, 1878. Its purpose was not only to furnish telephone service to more locations, but to license under the Bell patents the other companies desiring to furnish telephone service in New England. Again, Hubbard was the top officer of the concern. Theodore S. Vail, a man of unusual organizational abilities, was made general manager of this company shortly after its beginning. It is said that he was such a remarkable man that no aspect of the present Bell system is without the imprint of Vail's great spirit of service, his originality, his vigorous action, and his humane consideration of employees and customers. It was soon discovered that the New England Company was also too limited. To cover the business nationally, the officers of this company established a new company known as the National Telephone Company on February 17, 1879. This company's capitalization was raised to $850,000. It, in effect, took over the assets and responsibilities of the New England Telephone Company, as well as the original Bell Telephone Company. This was the forerunner company to handle some of the functions now performed by the present parent company of the Bell system, American Telephone and Telegraph Company, really known as AT&T. William H. Forbes became the first president of the National Telephone Company. He brought with him considerable capital of his own, as well as that of his well-to-do friends. Theodore Vail was made the general manager. Bell exchanges had been or were being established in the cities and towns across the eastern part of the country at a fast rate. Services were in great demand. The settlement of the Western Union lawsuit favorably added another 56,000 telephones to the organization. Not only all this growth, but above all else, many of the local companies, even though they were operating properly under the Bell licenses, they were facing most difficult problems of engineering, financing, or problems of a legal nature that they were unable to handle. The necessity of a single unified service was becoming more and more apparent. The National Bell Telephone Company was also inadequately structured or capitalized to do the required job. In 1880, the American Bell Telephone Company was established, hopefully to meet these foreseeable needs. A special act was passed by the Massachusetts legislature to allow the American Bell to incorporate a company up to $10 million capitalization limit and of such powers as this situation required. William H. Forbes was its president and Theodore S. Vail its general manager. This company replaced the National Bell Telephone Company. This remained as the Bell System parent company until 1899. During those years, there was much growth. In 1882, the Western Electric Company was acquired to manufacture or purchase all necessary telephone equipment and supplies. Thomas Watson moved out of the telephone engineering and research business in 1881, leaving his corps of engineers to be under the direction of Emil Berlinger. Over the years, staffs were formed to provide the licensee companies advisory services to aid them in meeting their engineering, technical, or business problems. American Bell, shortly after incorporation, proceeded to build a long-line toll route between Boston and New York City. It was found so successful on completion in 1884 that another separate and expensive long-distance construction program was immediately deemed necessary. It appeared that $30 million capitalization was required if American Bell was to build the necessary long-line services along with their other operations. Massachusetts refused the application. With the permission of the state of New York, it was decided to incorporate another telephone company in New York City for the purpose of building and operating long-distance lines. This brought the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T, into being on February 28, 1885. The Metropolitan Telephone and Telegraph Company that served New York City was brought into this new company as an operating company. Theodore Vail was elected president of AT&T, president of Metropolitan Telephone and Telegraph, and still remained general manager of American Bell Telephone Company. His original dream of a unified, interlocking telephone system was materializing. The American Bell was somewhat serving in that capacity, but finally in 1899, there were a merger of the two, making AT&T, with its long lines operation, the parent company of the Bell System, and thus absorbing the American Bell Telephone Company. In long lines growth, let's take a look. The National Long Distance Service extended from the Atlantic Seaboard to Buffalo in 1889. To Chicago in 1892, to Denver in 1911, to Salt Lake City in 1913, and finally nationwide service. On January 25, 1915, Alexander Graham Bell from New York City conversed with Thomas A. Watson at San Francisco to celebrate the transcontinental call occasion. Occasion. The present AT&T company had controlling interest in 23 operating telephone companies. It has 22 companies similar to Michigan Bell in the United States and also the Bell Telephone Company of Canada. Besides the operating companies, it has controlling interest in Western Electric Company, the Long Lines Company, and the Bell Telephone Laboratories. The Bell Labs grew to such size that it became a separate entity to the Bell System in 1925. To get an idea of the quantity of toll, that is long-distance calls, that the Bell System handled on an average day in 1976, they had 12 million interstate calls and 35 million total toll calls daily. As an example of their toll circuit capabilities, they have a coaxial cable from Pittsburgh to St. Louis that is capable of carrying 108,000 conversations at the same time. In the near future, by a millimeter waveguide system, they expect to carry 500,000 long-distance conversations simultaneously. We shall now resume this account at the local level. We have seen that AT&T had established long-distance service from the East Coast cities to Detroit or Chicago before there was local telephone systems in our communities to make use of them. We also see we will have plenty of circuits available for future toll calls. From conversations with citizens of Chesaning, Brant, and New Lothrop, as well as research by other means, it appears that Chesaning had telephone service in the late 1890s. Reliable reports tell us that by the turn of the century, Chesaning had a telephone office switchboard located in the rear of Albert Cantwell's General Store. This is the present location of Bert and Joe's Grocery Store at 202 West Broad Street. Likely this was operated by the Bell Telephone Company of Saginaw. As we know, they owned the service up till 1908. In 1908 and 1909, many items regarding Chesaning's telephone service were recorded in the Chesaning Argus file kept at the Chesaning Library. The subscribers were not too happy with their telephone service received from the Bell Telephone Company of Saginaw. They were facing a rate increase. Many were unhappy with their existing service, and many desired new service, especially rural, that was not available. On October 31, 1908, prospective stockholders of the Chesaning Home Telephone Company met. They signed an agreement to organize a company to buy the system from its present owner. The initial stockholders were Otis Sperry, George Pete, W.W. Burgess, Dr. D.W. Finley, Frank Greenfelder, John Jackson, Oliver Chapman, George Nason, Edward Long, Frank Stevens, John Haley, James Deverell, Lincoln Parshall, Byron Coryell, Adolph Greenebaum, Charles Cheney, Frank Walter, Charles Lee, C.C. Trask, Walker and Conley Furniture and Undertaking Company, H.B. Allen, and Willis Miller. They, with few exceptions, remained stockholders for many years, as it was an efficiently operated enterprise. The new company was incorporated for $30,000 capitalization on November 14, 1908. The purchase price paid Bell Telephone of Saginaw February 1, 1909 was $9,000. As soon as Chesaning Home took over, many new telephones were added. New roadway rural lines came into contract, and rebuilding the lines were being planned. The new company's first officers were W.W. Burgess, President, Edward T. Long, First Vice President, George M. Pete, Second Vice President, John W. Jackson, Treasurer, Charles W. Cheney, Secretary, and H.J. Pattison, Manager. Mr. Pattison, who formerly worked for Bell Telephone of Wyandotte, came to Chesaning to be the technical Mr. Telephone Man. Sometime before 1908, the telephone central office was established in a two-story building at 140 South Saginaw Street. Presently, the telephone switching equipment of Central Telephone Company is housed in a newer one-story building at that premise. To give an insight into the telephone business, right after Chesaning Home Telephone took over, the state audit of 1910 reported that the company received $7,280 revenue, about three-fourths from local and one-fourth toll service. The business customers were charged $18 per year, one-party residents $15, two-party residents $13.50, and four-party residents was $12 per year. Much of the rural service was roadway. Those subscribers owned their own lines and instruments and maintained their own equipment. They were each charged $3 per year to pay for the switching services. As an example of roadway rural service, as it was then handled, let's look at a report of the annual meeting of the Brady and Brant Rural Telephone Company, which took place at the home of President Oliver McFall on April 10, 1908.